The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, a close-up of that caravan of migrants headed our way.
These people are not refugees. They're not being persecuted by their governments. They're just living in kind of crappy countries.
A series of Democrats are sent suspicious packages.
This is terrorist.
We look at how rhetoric turns dangerous.
Shutting people down in a restaurant and throwing their food on the floor or doing what folks did to Pelosi, I think we're headed to a dark place.
And the left insists blacks are unable to vote with ID.
The majority of minorities support voter ID laws.
I'm Mark Davis from 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth. Great to be with you. Catch my program weekdays from anywhere in the country at 660amtheanswer.com. Thousands of migrants are winding their way through Mexico with the destination of the United States. This impoverished group began this trek in Central America. The Mexican government tried to stop them at the border, but failed. While some are seeking asylum in Mexico, most of them appear to be continuing the difficult trek toward our borders. So what happens when and if they reach the U.S.? That's anybody's guess. President Trump is promising to protect citizens from what some describe as an invasion. John Zmirak is senior editor of The Stream. He's been monitoring the migration, and he spoke with Salem host Dennis Prager.
You make the point that given that they're fleeing, theoretically, the persecution, this may be a first in history where the country you're fleeing persecution from, you march with their flag.
Right, right. I said, you know, when Franklin Roosevelt disgracefully turned back Jewish refugees from Nazi Germany, they were not waving Nazi flags and singing German nationalist songs and talking about how they were going to transform England, the U.S. and Germany's image. I mean, the people are mixing up the Jewish refugees from Germany with the German-American Bund, you know. These people are not refugees. They're not being persecuted by their governments. They're just living in kind of crappy countries. You know, and those countries are crappy for a reason, for historical and cultural and political reasons, because they never embraced ordered liberty. They inherited a bad dictatorial political culture from Spain, whereas we inherited a kind of anti-tyrannical, decentralized political structure from England. And as a result, they have worse governments and worse economies. They don't have secure property rights. That's one of the major things. There's a great Latin American economist. I think his name is Hernando Cortez. I think it's Cortez.
De Soto? Was it De Soto?
Hernando De Soto. And he said if you enforced property rights for the poor and let them protect their property rights from the government and from thugs and from drug lords, Latin America could be prosperous within a generation. But in the absence of it, they're fleeing to America. And we have a huge welfare magnet. A lot of these people, even if they come in and start working, their kids will grow up probably on public assistance. Large percentage of their family members are going to be on food stamps right away. Refugees get a whole honeypot full of benefits from the government.
So what do you think is going to happen when they reach the American border?
Well, my hope is that we will have the U.S. military lined up and choking off the entire border. And I think President Trump should he's already said this is a national emergency. He should start using defense funds to start constructing a wall. He ought to lay the cornerstone of the wall, gold-plated with a big T on it, and start building the wall and let Congress scream and yell. Let judges scream and yell. He should flout their court orders and continue to use his authority as commander-in-chief to seal the border and take money away from guarding Afghanistan's border, if necessary, to guard the United States' border. That's what we elected him for. We didn't elect Jeb Bush. We didn't elect Nikki Haley. We elected Donald Trump because we wanted to put America first. if we're going to be global policemen, you know what? Charity begins at home. And there's a crucial point, I think, because people feel a sense of moral ambivalence. Oh, these people, they just want to improve their lives. Okay, first of all, that's true of half the world. If you're going to say that if you pick up in Honduras and say, this sucks, I'm out of here, I'm going to the U.S., if that is enough to get you into the U.S., guess what? Most of the Islamic world would like to come too. Virtually everyone in China would like to come. I bet Bangladesh, Pakistan, you could empty the world into the United States, and our welfare system would be bankrupt within, 36 hours. But hey, at least we'd feel good about ourselves as we, starve to death and watch the civil war overwhelm our country and turn it into what I call a Kakistan, like so many other parts of the world. But what about the moral argument? I think we should see our country as a larger extension of our private homes. If somebody bangs on your door and says he's homeless and demands to live in your living room, you have the right to shut the door and use whatever force is required to stop someone from staying in your house and eating your food against your will. The exact same thing applies to us as a country. Is our country a common home that we work on and we improve and we leave to our children? We're grateful to our grandparents. We leave to our children. We judiciously accept newcomers who have something to offer. Or are we just a giant refugee camp like the ones we see in Turkey and Jordan, where anybody who shows up, you have to take them in and you put them on the same gruel and give them the same uniform and they gather around the same trash cans with a fire? Is that the future of America?
Talk to me politically. This is going to happen presumably right before the incredibly important congressional elections.
Right.
And I worry, given the utter bias of the media, that we will just have video after video and photo after photo of some American, either military person or ICE person or border guard, pushing some mom with a baby. And then it seems to me they win the propaganda war.
No, I think not. I think how they win the propaganda war? If these people set foot on U.S. soil, and then suddenly each one of them has all these legal rights and gets a George Soros-funded attorney.
Well, no, that's not the propaganda war. That's winning the war. I agree. But the propaganda war, let me just make this point. It seems to me that they win if they get in, and they win if they don't get in. I hope you're right. I pray you're right.
I think if Trump shows weakness, if he caves, then Republicans across the country, our heart sinks. We realize the game is over. Even Donald Trump can't stop this openly absurd, obviously false attempt to claim asylum and refugee status. If even Donald Trump can't say no to something this ludicrous and politically cooked up, then we're toast. And I think that would depress turnout.
Fine. I agree with you. I agree with you.
If he stands firm, that
will mean in pictorial form, that there will be fights between Americans and civilians from Latin America.
And I think that will help us, because I think people see that this is an invasion. They can see it. The people who are going to cry because a couple of people show up at the border and a soldier pushes them back, those people are already voting for the Democrats. But I don't think it's going to be enough to get people to turn out who weren't otherwise going to turn out. This is a national impeachment referendum. The left's base is already fanatical. They've got their Antifa hoods ready. They're ready to go to the polls. They've got their dead people registered to vote. The left is already at its maximum frenzy and hysteria. They've maxed out. What the Kavanaugh hearings did was wake up the Republican base and wake up the patriotic Americans to say, wait a minute, they're shredding our system of government, they're destroying our norms of justice. Oh, and now they're bringing in conquistadors to transform our country demographically by the thousands and thousands and thousands. No.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of that interview and sign up for the podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every day. Midweek, a cluster of bomb scares were reported at the offices and homes of a number of Democrats, among them George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and President Barack Obama. Hugh Hewitt discussed the threat with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. As you'll hear in the interview, Hugh was flirting with laryngitis, which explains why I'm in this chair today, but enough about that. Enjoy the segment.
Well, now, Senator Cruz, talk to me a little bit about these nine suspicious packages, at least one of which was a real bomb. The president's condemned it. The vice president's condemned it. Rod Rosenstein's condemned it. I'm sure you're going to condemn it. But the media is running with a narrative that it's Donald Trump's fault. I'm sure you see this, and it makes me crazy. It's either some nut in a basement or it's a hostile power messing with our election. But what do you make of the attempt to blame Trump?
Look, it's the media doing what the media does, which is any narrative that they can twist against Trump, they will do so. This is terrorism. I mean, this is terrorism, and whoever the terrorist is needs to be caught. He needs to be prosecuted. He needs to be put in jail for a long, long time. And I'm confident that'll happen. You know, it's interesting. You remember some months ago, we had the bomber in Austin that was setting off bombs throughout Austin, and I met with the ATF folks and the FBI folks that were leading that task force, and the federal law enforcement has tremendous resources to put to bear to track him down in terms of the components of the bomb. I know I'm sure they're analyzing all of those now. And we're going to catch this guy, and we're going to put him behind bars, but it is wrong. Violence is always wrong wherever it occurs on the political spectrum. We saw, tragically, a year ago, a crazed gunman coming to Washington, D.C., with the objective of shooting Republican congressmen and ultimately going to the congressional baseball practice and shooting and nearly killing Steve Scalise. And this should not be part of our political discourse. Disagreement is fine. It's even healthy to disagree on policy issues. But violence has no place in it, and we need to be able to disagree with each other with civility and with respect.
Do you believe that the Democrats will modify their behavior in the next 2 years, or has President Trump just simply driven them crazy?
He's clearly driven them crazy. They are in the fits and throes of Trump derangement syndrome. And some of it is, I think, they're captive to their base. Their far-left base, their radical base, is so furious that the only thing they see is hatred of Trump. So there's no good news. You see the lowest African-American unemployment in history, and they don't care because they hate Trump. You see the lowest Hispanic unemployment in history, and they don't care because they hate Trump. I think that fever is going to have to break. I think if we have a good election this year and keep the House, grow our majority in the Senate, I think that'll make a step. But my guess is it's going to take two good elections to break that fever, because their base remains just consumed with rage. And I think the incumbent Democrats are terrified of their base and in many ways feel captive to it.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
shutting people down in a restaurant and throwing their food on the floor or doing what folks did to Pelosi. I think we're headed to a dark place.
Senator Ben Sasse, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. The bomb scares on Democrats this week followed mob attacks on a number of Republicans in prior weeks, the latest being Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his wife. Just days before the bomb scares, Hugh Hewitt spoke with Senator Ben Sasse, who recently authored the book Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal.
Senator, what did you make of that audio? I'm sure you've seen the tape. Nancy Pelosi was also assaulted this weekend. What do you make of this?
Yeah, to what end? What do these people think their goal is? Because right now, there are so many people who are allowing their political passions to swallow up everything else in their lives that they're thinking it's normal to just scream at people at a restaurant and throw their food on the table. This is not a question about whether or not your First Amendment rights allow you to protest. They certainly do. But America starts with a fundamental assumption about what the good life is. And we don't think that power is the end. Power is a means to maintain order so that people can have dinner time discussion and debate with family and friends and even people they don't agree with on everything. But shutting people down in a restaurant and throwing their food on the floor or doing what folks did to Pelosi, I think we're headed to a dark place. And I think there are a lot of political addicts out there that are not really thinking through chess moves 3, 4, and 5 yet.
Senator Sass, you have written a brand new book, Them, which I want to talk about. My copy is in Virginia, but I'll still talk to you about it. But I do believe in that tape you heard part of the problem. I'm going to sell it to TZM. We have monetized confrontation. We have actually made it profitable and a path to celebrity to be a jerk and to yell and scream at people. I don't know that the people, as you say, have thought 3 and 4 and 5 moves ahead, because that's a path that goes towards ever-increasing confrontation.
Yeah, well said. I really do think we don't have a shared understanding across 320 million of us of the moment in which we're living, both in media consumption and media maybe as a subset of technology more broadly. I think the big tension in our moment that would be useful for us to reflect on, and a lot of why I wrote the book, Them, is the tension between rootlessness and rootedness. The happiness literature is showing us something that, you know, sort of thoughtful people and people who had grandparents and older wisdom in their life have probably known for millennia. But there are about 4 things that drive happiness. Do you have a nuclear family? Do you have a couple of deep friendships? Do you have meaningful work and shared vocation and coworkers? And do you have a local worshiping community? Those 4 ingredients are basically what drive whether or not humans are happy. That's all that stuff is about rootedness. And our technology is allowing us to start to think of ourselves as completely rootless. And the way that we're consuming media and the way that we're thinking about political tribalism is a function of that sort of TMZ mindset you're flagging right there.
I'm sure you read David Brooks's column, The Rich White Civil War, last week, based on the Hidden Tribes study. And it is, in fact, not a problem of the center. It is a problem of the extremes on left and right, that they constantly want to catapult abuse at each other. But it is also one that is powered by anonymity. And I'm wondering, Senator Sass, what do you think of anonymous comments and the tenor they bring to our politics?
Yeah, great flags on both points. So first of all, I think the study you're referring to, Hidden Tribes, is great. Your listener should go read it. David Brooks' piece in the New York Times early last week was one of the best summaries of it. And one of the things that he says that's so brilliant is when you take apart, so these demographers and social scientists tried to look at America and figure out where are we on politics. And so often we just think of it as right versus left. But there is another dimension, which is intensity of thinking that politics should crowd out the rest of life. I'm the 2nd or 3rd most conservative voter in the U.S. Senate, but I'm a huge skeptic of the idea that you can put politics at the center of your life and actually live well and love your neighbor well. And what Brooks flagged was 2 of the 7 tribes that are identified in that study, Hidden Tribes, 2 of the 7 that are most politically addicted are the 8% on the far left that pay constant attention to politics. They're rich and white, and the 6% on the far right that pay constant attention to politics, they're rich and white, and 86% of America is saying, go away, you people are weird. Politics is a means to an end so that I can coach Little League and live in my local community. And this idea that politics should crowd everything else out, it's wrong. It's never been an American idea. And right now, a huge part of what we're going through is that 14% telling the 86%, you're weird that you want to live in community. The 86% are right.
As America inches closer to Election Day 2018, voter interest is extremely high, especially among Republicans. One of the common themes among Democrats, though, is the claim that Republicans are using voter ID to suppress the minority vote. Anybody ever ask minorities about this? Here's Larry Elder, syndicated Salem talker.
I'm holding in my baby brown libertarian fingers, and we're going to put up on LarryElder.com an article from the National Review, August 23, 2016. The majority of minorities support voter ID laws. It doesn't mean that the voter ID laws aren't racist, right? It doesn't mean they aren't disproportionately negatively affecting people of color. It just means that people of color are too stupid to realize it. According to Gallup, 77% of American Hispanics and 77% of blacks support voter ID laws. Quote, the figure is essentially the same among whites. 81% back voter ID laws. End of quote. You know anybody that doesn't have ID? And if you know somebody who doesn't have ID, does that person not have the ability to get ID? And if you don't have ID, do you really think that such a person is motivated to vote in the first place? Amy Horowitz went out to ask white people what they thought about voter ID laws. And on and on and on, these white college kids thought the voter ID laws were racist. Why? Because they thought black people were just too incapable or stupid to get ID.
Do you have an opinion on voter ID laws?
Yeah, they're usually pretty racist and they're bad. I think voter ID laws are a way to perpetuate racism.
Would you say would you go as far to say those laws are racist?
For sure.
Do you think it suppresses the African-American vote?
Definitely. Because they're less likely to have state IDs.
Minority voters are less likely to have the kinds of IDs that have been described or required.
These type of people don't live in areas with easy access to DMVs or other places where they can get identification.
You can always get IDs you do over the internet. Does that also make it difficult for black people in particular?
Yeah, you have to have access to the internet. You have to be able to pay an internet service provider for certain fees.
Do you think that's harder for black people to go online?
Well, I feel like they don't have the knowledge of how it works.
A lot of people have smartphones, but you might not have data.
For most of the communities, they don't really know what is out there just because they're not aware or like they're not informed.
Now I'm here in East Harlem to ask black people their thoughts on what you just heard. Do you have ID normally? Do you carry ID around?
Yes, I have state ID.
Do you carry ID?
Yes, I do.
Do you know any black person who doesn't carry ID?
No. Everyone that I know has an ID. Why would they think we don't have ID?
That's a lie. Why would they say that?
Do you have ID?
Yes.
I heard a lot also that black people can't figure out how to get to the DMV.
Really?
What does that say to you?
I know where that is on 25th Street.
Do you know where the ID, the DMV is right here?
It's on 125th Street and 3rd Avenue, I believe.
You know how to get there?
Yeah.
Do you have a problem getting there if you have to get there?
No.
I know these sound like silly questions. You know how to get to the DMV?
Of course.
You know where it is?
Yes.
You can get there?
Uh-huh.
No problem.
No problem.
Just checking.
Okay.
And I also heard a lot that black people, especially poor black people, have no access to the internet, can't figure out how to use the internet.
That's just stupidity, honestly. Everybody has access to the internet. Even a little kid can figure out how to work the internet.
What does that say to you for the people who have this perception of black people?
They're pretty much ignorant. That's what my thought process is.
I just think that's ignorant.
Ignorant.
Ignorant. That's the word I hear
a lot.
Ignorant.
Ignorant. Very, very ignorant. Who are these people talking to?
Do you have a problem that if you go to vote and they say, can we please see your ID to make sure you are who you say you are? Are you
cool? Love showing my ID.
You got no problem with that?
Nope.
I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. We saw this week how valuable and how strategic the efforts of ADF are as they contend for our first freedoms in the courts. They really are the best and the brightest contending for the values we share. Go to townhallreview.com, find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
I wrote this children's book because I think our side needs something that says this is our narrative. This is what we think is happening.
Eric Metaxas, when the Town Hall Review continues in just a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. Eric Metaxas wrote this wonderful book, Bonhoeffer, followed years later with another called Martin Luther. This is heady stuff. Well, it turns out Eric Metaxas is a versatile guy. His latest book, for kids, or is it, has that look, but I think it's for grown-ups too. It's called Donald Drains the Swamp, and it's about Donald Trump. He's depicted on the cover as a caveman carrying a club. It's just a great piece of work. Eric joined Hugh on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Now, here's the clip I want you to listen to and react to, because it's about the impediments to draining the swamp in your book, Donald Drains the Swamp. Brooke Baldwin, very good person. I know her aunt. She's a wonderful anchor, but she screwed up last week, and she went on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert to talk about it. Cut number two.
You got in a little trouble with the Twitter people recently because you said one of your guests called Democratic protesters mob,
right.
A mob. And you said, we're not going to use the M word around here.
I did.
You got a lot of flack for that. What happened?
So we had Matt Lewis on, who I love having on from The Daily Beast, and he brought up the word mob. And at the time, the mob word had been this talking point from Republicans from all up and down Capitol Hill in the wake of what had happened with Dr. Ford and Justice Kavanaugh. And so when he brought the mob word up again. I call them out. And listen, like, I don't want to be the word police, and that was not my intention. But I also believe in calling out talking points. And to hear him bring that up, I had to say something. And honestly, at the end of my day, like, I'm sure you check your Twitter too. And if I have irked the left and the right, then I've done my job.
Now, Eric, the alpha talking point is, if I've irked the left and the right, I have done my job. That is like the archetypal talking point of all
time. How many times have I said that? How many times have others said that? And you know what? Guess what? You know what? Clichés are usually true, and talking points are often true. And the mob talking point, what is more true than the fact is that the left has descended into mobs threatening violence? That is so pathetic and so un-American. If we don't call that out, shame on us. That is not the American way. In fact, it is the antithesis of everything we've always stood for. And you know what? Speaking of Stephen Colbert, this book, I'm not kidding, my book, Donald Drains the Swamp, I want it to topple his nasty, sour, anti-Trump fake children's book, Whose Boat Is This Boat, or whatever. The reason I wrote this book, Hugh, is that the left is always putting out things into the culture, right? Here's a children's book that he wrote, which is not a children's book. It's nasty. No kid would look at it. It's for adults to make fun of the president and to feel morally superior. I wrote my book because I thought we don't have things like that on the right for conservatives who want to celebrate what America is, who believe Ronald Reagan was a great man. I think that we need stuff like that. And I get very...
I got to interrupt you because you just got a tweet from Jamie Weinstein, who's kind of a Never Trumper, and he was just on the show earlier, and I tweeted out you were coming up to talk about your book, Donald Drains the Swamp, and Jamie kind of snarked out, well, that seems like a very special children's book for your three-year-old who is fed up with the permanent political class. I just said to Jamie, you ought to have him on your podcast, Jamie, because I think you would mix up, because you know that other children's books have been used this way.
Oh, look, this is always the case. And Mike, you know that even though I'm political, I'm not as political as you and some others. I'm mostly a cultural guy. I'm in the culture like Stephen Colbert. But conservatives, we don't really have a voice in the culture, right? Stephen Colbert has a talk show. Tons of people like that have talk shows. We don't have anybody, effectively speaking, who have talk shows like that. I wrote this children's book because I think our side needs something that says this is our narrative. This is what we think is happening. We think he's a folk hero. You want to call him a caveman? Go ahead. But he's our caveman, and we're actually proud of some of the stuff he's getting done. And why don't we talk about it? I mean, Stephen Colbert's not going to have me on the show to talk about it, but I got to tell you, this is the kind of thing, this is the reason I wrote the book. Donald Drains the Swamp is meant to be a cultural object. We have to get our side of the story out there, and this is one of the ways we do it. As much as I love talk radio, you and I have talk radio shows, but there are other ways to get things out there. And the fact that that Stephen Colbert's fake children's book, which is mean-spirited, is number one on Amazon, I said this morning I have to bring that up on your show. Our side needs to understand we're losing that battle, and that's a very important battle.
Well, I think you tweet at Jamie. Jamie said he'd love to have you on his podcast, and it's very widely circulated. And I also think you ought to send it to people like David Brooks. Did you read Brooks's column this week about the rich white Civil War? Go read The Rich White Civil War by David Brooks. It's about how the left and right have separated into camps and the
disparity. You said so. I like David Brooks. I just, in the last year, I haven't been able to read his stuff, but I'll read it because you said so. You think he'll read my book? I don't think so. But I'm going to tell you something. We need to get our happy side of the narrative out there. It's not all about Stormy Daniels. It's about happy stuff we can share with our kids. We can teach them about what American-style self-government is, which is not a mob. Thank you very much.
To hear this entire interview, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
I was having public meltdown, getting into fights.
A reporter comes clean on his addiction to marijuana when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review, brought to you in our partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Mark Davis, sitting in for Hugh Hewitt. Neil Pollack has had a successful writing career, best-selling author, columns in a variety of outlets, but he recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. It took a lot of courage. He admitted to his long-term pot addiction, how marijuana nearly destroyed his life. Covered it here on the Town Hall Review a couple of weeks ago, and we returned to it as this time Salem host Michael Medved spoke with Mr. Pollack.
I just wanted to ask you at the outset, your piece was actually scary and sad and very honest. How many years did you feel that you had a problem with marijuana?
I mean, it's hard to gauge how many years I actually had a problem. I smoked pretty regularly for more than two decades, and I would say at least the last 15 years or so, I overdid it. So a long time.
How do you know you overdid it?
Well, now that I'm sober, I can look back on some of my behaviors when I was high and realize that pot was causing a lot of my problems. You know, I was having public meltdowns, even temper tantrums. Even I was getting into fights. I was doing crazy stuff in public that I probably wouldn't have done if I'd been sober. You know, and I also wasn't sleeping normally. And in addition to that, I spent a lot of my time thinking about marijuana, about how to get it, about how to consume it, about who to consume it with, about trips I could take that would revolve around marijuana. And, you know, it just kind of became the center of my life for a very long time.
And this was during a period of time when you were making a pretty good career for yourself as a writer. You've been married for a while, right?
I've been married for 18 years, and I have a son. And the whole time I was stoned. You know, I was basically like a professional hipster, right? I mean, I published I published 10 books. I had a couple of script deals in Hollywood. I've written for, you know, pretty much every English language publication except for the New Yorker. You know, it's not like I was an unambitious stoner or a failure, but I sometimes wonder how much more successful I would have been if I hadn't been soaked in marijuana the whole time. And I certainly would have, lived my life with more integrity and carried out my business affairs with maybe more efficiently. And I also just would have been able to devote more time to my family.
How long have you been sober?
My 1 year anniversary is November 11th.
And what advantages do you see now that you're not smoking pot on a regular basis?
You know, it's kind of difficult to quantify because in some ways marijuana was a creative force in my life. I would, I wrote almost all my books high all the time. And I can't, although in retrospect, there are a lot of scenes in the novels that are about getting high. I think there'd be fewer of those. But, it helped me come up with certain flights of fancy and decent jokes. And it was a creative stimulant in some ways. But so I've actually been, I would say, like in some ways less creative since I stopped smoking pot. But everything else in my life is so much better. I mean, I'm more present for my family and my friends. I feel like my life is in order professionally in a way that it wasn't. There's not as much chaos. And most importantly, I'm not having the emotional highs and lows that I was having when I was using marijuana. So I'm not having those meltdowns that would characterize sort of my addiction cycle.
One thing you mentioned, you've been married for 18 years. Did your wife ever share your enthusiasm for weed?
No, and in fact, she's the opposite. No, she has no interest in it at all. And she many, many times tried to tell me that I had a problem. I would just, I would just shuffle her off. Because the myth is that marijuana isn't addictive. In some ways, it's considered a health food. And so I just, even though I have a history of alcoholism in my family, and obviously have the addiction gene, it just didn't register with me. Maybe it should have, if I was ducking behind the dumpster on the way, walking to the gym so I could, take a hit so I could be high while I was working out. That's not the sign of someone who's necessarily healthy. But, I didn't see it. She did. And she was so grateful when I finally made the decision to quit.
You know, you use the figures in your piece, and I think they're generally accepted figures. They're from the Journal of the American Medical Association, and based on studies done in a number of countries, they suggest that some 9% of people who ever use marijuana end up getting addicted, and 17% of people use marijuana as teenagers. Did you first use a weed as a teenager?
When I was a teenager, and this was, you know, in the 1980s, I was sort of a go-getter, do-gooder, student council type, sort of a modeling myself, maybe not politically, but like at least in terms of my lifestyle on, you know, Michael J. Fox's character from Family Ties.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was my model. Like, I was going
right,
to college.
Right.
I was going to be successful. I was going to be a great American citizen. And so pot didn't really play into it. You know, in college, I kind of, I went a little, I'm a member of Generation X, and so, I became kind of a grouchy pop culture cynic, but I still wasn't doing a lot of drugs. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I really started consuming it. So it was an adult onset of addiction.
Have you ever tried to calculate how much money you invested in buying weed over the years?
Oh, I mean, it was probably a few thousand dollars. You know, the thing is, and this isn't a brag, it's just a fact. You know, there was a time there where I was a, you know, well-known writer, and people would just give me drugs or smoke me up. And I'm kind of inherently cheap, so I would look for situations where I knew I'd be around people who would have it, so I wouldn't have to buy it. But of course, I still would sometimes. You know, when I lived in L.A., I had a medical marijuana card. I'd go up to Colorado for a week, and I'd spend $100-$200. So it didn't bankrupt me in that sense, but it was still even on a month where I was really good at mooching, it was still costing me at least $50, not $100.
Now, you've written since you've written this piece, and it's obviously caused a great stir. Have you gotten some negative reaction from some of your old friends?
Oh, no. People have been very supportive.
I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. We saw this week how valuable and how strategic the efforts of ADF are as they contend for our first freedoms in the courts. They really are the best and the brightest contending for the values we share. Go to townhallreview.com, find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Liberals know there's something morally wrong with allowing a man body to race in a female race. They know it, but they have no guts to confront the left.
Dennis Prager with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in just a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. You know there are plenty of debatable issues and the controversies over transgender policies these days, but one that seems particularly troubling is the idea that biological males are allowed to compete against women as women. Physically, men, as a rule, remain stronger, faster, quicker. This takes away a female's ability to compete on a level playing field. That's grossly unfair. So as Dennis Prager explains, it's just another area where the left has corrupted everyday life. Another is the mob mentality, disrupting a politician who's simply trying to enjoy a meal with his wife. Here's Dennis.
See the video about Mitch McConnell? These people come screaming into a restaurant. You're going to have to fight back, folks. If people come screaming into the restaurant, including my side, if my side went screaming into a restaurant where a leading Democrat was having a lunch or dinner, I would get rid of them as readily. I would consider them as disgusting as their side. There are some people who shout at Nancy Pelosi, which I'm not for, by the way. This is the new rules, but there are no rules. That's the whole point. The only rules for the left are the ones the left want to pass. Like, you must allow a male who considers himself to be a female to run in a women's race. This narcissist who did this last week. And it's amazing it goes uncommented on in the United States. Men are winning female races. It is the end of female competition if this continues. It's so amazing to me, the sickness that the left has bred into the American bloodstream, that we are supposed to have pity for this person, not for the women who are racing. It is beyond belief that all the compassion goes to the man who feels he's a woman. And I have compassion for men who think they're women. But I also have compassion for all the women who want to run against women's bodies. Women body versus women body. That's the way it should work. But the gutless liberal allows the mean-spirited leftist to win every time. That's the way it works. Liberals know there's something morally wrong with allowing a man body to race in a female race. They know it, but they have no guts to confront the left. The liberals are cowards and leftists are mean. And that's it. And that's a bad combination, because cowardice allows meanness to win. Do only conservatives give a damn if a male wins a female race? Is that what you have to be? You have to be a conservative to say something is wrong here? What does that say about liberals and leftists? It's unbelievable. The women, they're so intimidated. They can't say, you know what? This is not fair. The one who came in second would have come in first. She was deprived completely unfairly of her right to win the race. Oh, the statements by this male who believes he's a female is, you know, this is a great day for equal rights. No, it isn't. It's an awful day for equal rights.
Hey, thank you for joining us for this edition of The Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Thanks so very much to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Jim Bartow, Bobby Belt. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.